So building a hosted service cloud infrastructure using the multi-tenant cloud capabilities of the new CloudOS platform when we're looking at System Center 2012 R2, Windows 2012 R2. So you're going to see this slide a lot over the next couple of days, okay? Because it covers everything that we're going to cover for the next 3 days, okay? So we're really going to be talking really this morning around that Windows Server 2012 box. Okay, that's what we're mainly going to be focusing on today. So trying to deliver this platform, we're trying to give you a true multi-tenant cloud, a cloud that's scalable and scales fast and rapidly. We're trying to give you a highly available platform at the same time so that you can meet the 3.9s, 4.9s, 5.9s that you need to meet for your customers' SLAs. We're also trying to give you proper automation tools so that you can automate the process of deployment, but also the processes for managing that cloud and environment. Okay? It's not just about, oh yes, the customer can go and click a button and a server's deployed. They can click a button and it deletes the server. It's also about the back-end management of that platform, what your engineering team have to do on a daily basis. So what we're going to cover in this session is going to be around secure isolation between tenants. How do we securely isolate tenants at the hypervisor? Okay, we're not worrying about your physical network. We're going to be totally focused on how do we do it in Hyper-V without having to worry about your switches or routers. We're also going to be talking quality of service. How do we guarantee that each VM is getting the services it needs and the resources it needs? We're also going to be going through and discussing VM mobility. How do we move VMs around? How do we ship them? How do we move them from one environment to another environment, from one storage solution to another one, or from one cluster to another cluster, or from on-premise into your cloud? How do we do that process? And most importantly, you're going to get to play with the technology, okay? Over the next 3 days, it's not just about me coming up here and giving you death by PowerPoint. It's also about you playing with the technology in the labs, okay? It's about you playing and building the environment yourself. So hopefully by the time you leave these next couple of sessions, you will have the ability to go back and have a better understanding of the technology and use it in your own POCs and in your own environment and see how it really works in your real world, not just our lab environment here. So some of the challenges host service providers are facing at the moment are full isolation between tenant workloads. How do we guarantee that our customers' workloads are isolated? How do we protect and secure those workloads? Requirements for granular metering. How do I guarantee that my customer, when they're paying me for a specific amount of RAM, CPU, and storage, that they're getting it? And how can I prove that to the customer? Also, guaranteeing that the allocation of shared resources is fair and distributed. And being able to move customers' VMs from their premise into your cloud without having to reconfigure them. How many of you can do that today? How many of you can go to a customer's site, grab the VMs, drop them onto your hypervisor and not have to re-IP them? No one? That's the sort of functionality we're talking about. Being able to go to a customer, pick up their workload, drop it into your cloud, and not have to reconfigure it. We're also talking about a fully secure process, not having customers see each other, not having to rely on your physical networks to do that isolation. Most of you at the moment will be using VLAN IDs on your physical network. We're taking that same type of concept and we're virtualizing it. So you can get some of those VLAN IDs back. Okay? When we start looking at your infrastructure, do your Exchange backend servers or SQL servers need to be publicly on the internet? Does your Exchange backend server need to talk to other things other than AD? We're talking about reevaluating what does my customers' VMs actually need to talk to other than each other? Is it only one server out of the whole private cloud that needs to get on the internet or speak to the rest of my network? Also, giving you accurate, streamlined methods for billing and monitoring. We're also going to be talking about predictable performance. How many of you at the moment can guarantee that your customers are getting the same performance day in, day out? I know most of you can't guarantee that. How many of you can actually prove what performance they're getting? How many of you can actually go, you know what, at any time I can log on to my system and get the resources that the customer's been using for the last 24, 48, 30 days? There's only one or two people in the room. So that's the sort of capability we're talking about. Being able to say, you know what, I know that they're getting this much CPU time, this much network traffic. That's what you want to be able to do. When the customer rings you and says, my server is not performing the way we want to for it to perform, and we don't believe we're getting the performance that you're guaranteeing us, you can then turn around and say to them, well, this is what your server is using right now. Your server is guaranteed to be using this much RAM, this much CPU, this much network I/O, and this much disk I/O. That's the sort of functionality we're giving you in 2012 R2. So when we look at the multi-tenant cloud requirements, we're talking about secure isolation, resource metering, QoS, and VM mobility. And some of the ways we deliver that is with PVLANs, Hyper-V network virtualization gateways. We're also talking about the extensible switch, virtual port ACLs, trunk mode VMs, as well as ARP and ND protection. So how many of you at the moment in your hypervisor can do ACLs between VMs? That's the level that we can deliver on the Hyper-V platform. And you're going to play with that in your labs, and we're going to show you that in the demo shortly. Resource metering, network QoS, storage QoS, which is new in R2. Network virtualization, live migration with compression is new. We have live migration over RDMA. So for those of you who've done a lot of investing into the RDMA technologies, you can take advantage of that. For those that haven't looked at RDMA technologies, I recommend that you do. We've done some testing, and you roughly takes about a third of the time it does on normal traditional network technology. So when we turn on RDMA to do live migrations and things like that, it takes about a third of the time that it does traditionally over a 10 gig network. Look at storage live migration and shared nothing live migration. So secure isolation between tenants. So one of the examples up on that slide deck that we have at the moment is we have Blue Company and Red Company. Okay? They're both coming into our cloud. The first problem you would probably notice is that they're both using 192.168.0.0/24. Traditionally, on most environments, that would be a problem. With the new network virtualization, it isn't a problem. We create two virtual networks for each tenant, a virtual network for each tenant. We put their VMs into each of those isolated networks. They can't see each other. They can't talk to each other. Their VMs stay on that range. If they're still using that environment back on their premise, okay, if their internal network is still using those same IPs back in the office, we can use the advantage of the multi-tenant VPN gateway and NVGRE to connect into their environments as well. And it can do the translation and traffic routing from their private VLAN and private network all the way through to their on-premise environment. Okay? There's some networking configurations that you have to do to get that to work, and the tenant has to have the capability on their end. Okay, but we can deliver that. Whether it's us putting a Microsoft Gateway server on-premise or whether their gateway devices, etc., on-premise already have those capabilities.
Question. If they bring an IP range that conflicts with one that we're using in our actual backend, what happens then?
Yep, so if a customer brings... The question is, if a customer brings their IP range, which could be a 10.10.something range, and it conflicts with my hosting internal domain, what happens then? As long as we're putting them in an isolated network, nothing. It will still function.
What if they actually need to communicate?
Yep, you can still communicate. So when we go through the sessions a little bit later, we're going to go into how that technology works in a lot more detail. But we pretty much encapsulate them, put a customer address range over the top, and you have a hosting range, okay? And they'll be able to communicate through the gateway device.
Okay.
Okay? Yep, so the question is, if one of these isolated network companies need internet access, how do they get it? They go through the gateway device. Okay? The gateway device does the translation between the virtual network and your physical network, or a virtual network and another virtual network. Okay? And we're going to go through that in a bit more detail as we go through the slides. So the question is the NVGRE encrypted? Can I go through that in a little bit later? Because we've got a couple of slides on that a little bit later. Thanks. So out of the box, with the 2012 R2 solution, we have that in-box multi-tenant edge gateway now. Okay? In 2012, there was no edge gateway from Microsoft. You had to use a third-party product. In R2, we're now supplying that edge gateway device. Isolated virtual networks are now running on shared network infrastructure. So you'll be using the same network technology you use today. The switches and routers don't know anything about the virtualized networks, okay, unless it goes through the gateway. Standards-based automation for that network configuration. You can actually let the customer create their own network through the Windows Azure pack. So if you use Windows Azure pack or a third-party control panel, you can actually let that user create that VM network themselves. It's not something your engineers actually have to do. Partner ecosystem support. So as I said, third-party control panel vendors are tying in. Switching and networking devices are tying in as well. Yes, Scott?
So which control panel partners are tying in?
So which control panel partners are tying in? I can't answer that because I don't know where they're all at the moment. We'll have to come back to that a little bit later. So for those that couldn't hear what Scott said, he said that as far as Scott's concerned, he's spoken to most of the vendors. Most of the third-party control panel vendors have committed to integration with this product and process. Okay, so it may be 6 months away, it may be 12 months away. It depends on the individual vendor what that time frame will be. So hosting server provider benefits. It simplifies bring your own IP. So customers that are used to using their IP ranges can bring it into your cloud and use it. Yes, you can still force customers if you want to use your IP ranges, but it's much simpler and a more attractive process to customers if they can just ship their existing IP ranges into your cloud. It also means that scalability, some of the scalability issues you're having on your physical networks can be relieved. One of the big things we find when we discuss things with service providers is they're running out of VLAN IDs on their physical networks. Okay? If they're having to give a customer that brings a VM in and goes, you know what, I've got one VM, but I want my own VLAN ID, okay? You've just wasted a physical VLAN ID on one VM, okay? With the virtual networks, we're able to remove that requirement to give a customer with one VM a whole VLAN ID and range, okay? So we're trying to give back and take away some of those pain points that customers are experiencing. But it's also giving you a solution to be able to bridge the gap between customer's premise and your cloud and making it a seamless network, seamless process to communicate between the two environments. So the Hyper-V extensible switch is a layer 2 network switch for virtual machine connectivity. Okay? So we're doing the communication between the VMs at the layer 2 level. The virtual Ethernet switch runs on the management OS of the host, okay? So if you don't use Virtual Machine Manager, you have to configure all the VLANs and network configurations on each of your hosts manually, okay? So we highly recommend you use VMM for all the management of your hosts, whether it's clusters or standalone servers. It exists on Windows Server Hyper-V and Windows Client Hyper-V. So if you're running Windows 8, or Windows 8.1, or whether you're running Windows Server 2012 or 2012 R2, you have the same technology. So if you want to test it and play with it, you can do it on your own desktops if you want to. Extensible by partners and customers. So we're seeing other partners, network providers, tying into this solution as well. So they're extending the switch, working with their own network devices to integrate into this solution. So virtual machines connecting to the extensible switch with their virtual network adapter combined to a physical NIC or team. And as I said earlier, there's a lot of good stories we're going to discuss around the teaming. And then we also have bypassing or bypassed by SRIOV, okay? So if you turn on SRIOV, okay, you're going to minimize the ability to do a lot of the virtual network capability on that network adapter, okay? So when you start looking at offloading some of the network traffic to the hardware devices, you are potentially going to disable yourself from using some of the virtual network capabilities as well, okay? So the Hyper-V extensible switch, we have PVLANs to enable us to isolate our tenants, so they'll have a private virtual local area network. We have virtual port ACLs that enable management tools to configure the isolation between multiple tenants running on the same infrastructure. We have ARP and ND protection against DHCP snooping and guarding. We have protection from address resolution, protocol, neighbor discovery, so ARP, ND poisoning and spoofing. We also have trunk mode, so the capability to trunk additional VLANs to virtual machines. So if you have multiple virtual or multiple networks that you need to attach to a VM, so if you've got multiple VLAN IDs on your physical network, we can attach those multiple VLAN IDs to your VM. In earlier versions of Hyper-V, you were restricted to one VLAN ID per NIC. Okay, so if you had to do multiple like VLAN IDs, you had to do like multiple NICs. So in 2012 and 2012 R2, we can have multiple VLAN IDs on a single NIC. Virtual machine isolation with PVLANs. So when we turn on PVLANing, we have three modes that we can do in PVLANs. One is isolated, where isolated ports cannot exchange packets with another at layer two. Okay? It means it's totally isolated. We have promiscuous mode. When we turn on promiscuous mode, ports can exchange packets with any other port on the same primary VLAN ID. Okay? Just keep in mind, primary VLAN ID, not secondary VLAN IDs. In community mode, ports on the same VLAN ID can exchange packets with any other at layer 2 as long as they have the same VLAN ID. It can be secondary, tertiary VLAN IDs as long as it has the same VLAN ID somewhere. So in the sample down there, you'll see guest OS 1, guest OS 2, they're on the same IP range, but because they're on separate primary and they're isolated, you won't be able to see each other. Okay, so that's isolated mode. In community mode, all the VMs on the right-hand side in green can all communicate with each other because they're on the same VLAN IDs. But as you can see, even though guest OS 4 and guest OS 2 and 1 have the same VLAN ID of 2, okay, guest OS 4 and 5 can't talk to guest OS 1 and 2. Okay, one set in community mode, one set in isolated mode. Okay, so the isolated servers won't talk to the other servers. Guest OS 3, we now have another machine on the same IP range. It has VLAN IDs 2 and 5. It's in promiscuous mode, so it can talk to some of the servers because of the way the configurations are done. It's a bit hard to see and understand when you see it on the board. When you actually go through the lab and the demonstration with Craig shortly, you'll get a better understanding of how that works. I find it much easier when I'm actually doing it than just seeing the diagram up on the board. Virtual port ACLs for network isolation and metering. One of the core capabilities of the Hyper-V extensible switch is that we can have ACL policies to consist of allow and deny rules for connectivity between VM IPs and MAC addresses. And we support both MAC addresses IPv4 and IPv6. Okay? So you can allow a source or destination on any IP address or MAC address. You can deny a source or destination based on IP or MAC, as well as meter a source or destination based on IP or MAC address. So we can actually meter traffic in and out of a network adapter on a VM. Unfortunately, at the moment, we can't tell you where the traffic's going and coming from. All we can tell you is the megabytes in and the megabytes out. Okay? I'm sure, hopefully down the track, we will get that feature, but it's not in there just yet. ARP and ND spoofing and DHCP guard protection. They're to help you protect against any customers that decide to try and snoop and find other customers on your network and things like that, and to help protect your customers' environments. So ensure the security of each tenant on the system using the extensible switch so we can do true isolation. One of the benefits of having the, just taking a step back for a sec, having the VLAN IDs and being able to do your ACLs means that potentially you could actually have VMs on the same IP address without being in separate networks but on the same network and actually set up ACLs based on MAC addresses and isolate servers. Okay? So you could actually, without having to create separate virtual networks, so for example, if you have customers that have one or two VMs, you may not want to still create a private virtual network. You could still isolate those people and those VMs based on the ACLs. A little bit harder to manage, but you can still do it. So there's two platforms for extensions. There's the NDIS, the Network Device Interface Specifications, or there's the Windows Filtering Platform Callout Drivers. Okay, so when we look at that diagram over there on the right, we can see that we have our virtual machines with their VM NICs. We then have our host NIC in the middle, and then we have our virtual switch, which has extension protocols, capture extensions, filtering extensions, forwarding extensions, and extension mini ports. The Hyper-V extensible switch, some of the benefits we get, it's an open platform to fuel plugins. Okay, means other people can write their own plugins to that switch and extend it the way they want to extend it. You yourself could even write your own extensions if you wanted to and not rely on just network vendors or other people to do that for you. Core services are free. There are no charges from Microsoft for the virtual networking or the extensible switch. Extensions experience a high level of reliability and quality as long as they go through the Windows logo certification program. So if someone writes their own extensions to the switch and they go through the Microsoft Windows platform and logo certification program, if anything goes wrong with that or you have troubleshooting issues, you'll get assistance from Microsoft and the vendor because it's been certified on the platform. Unified management. The management of the extensions is all integrated into the Windows PowerShell modules, etc. So you can use PowerShell and WMI calls to manage the environment. It's easier to support. Unified tracing means that it's easier to diagnose the issues that you can have on your extensible switch. And multi-tenants can exist securely on the same data center network without having to worry about your physical network doing the isolation. Multi-tenant VPN gateway is a bridge between your VM networks and your physical network. Okay? I've had a lot of people come and ask me during the break, How do we get VMs to talk to other VMs or VMs talk to my load balancers or firewalls? We do that through this VPN gateway server, okay? The multi-tenant VPN gateway is only available in Windows Server 2012 R2. It's able to have guest clustering for high availability, so you can actually cluster it so that you've got high availability for that gateway role. We do BGP for dynamic route updates. We encapsulate and decapsulate NVGRE packets. And it's also multi-aware NAT for internet access. Okay? So if you have an isolated VM network, you have a VM that's in that network that needs to access the internet or be published to the internet, it goes through the gateway to get to your load balancer or your firewall. Okay? So the gateway device is the device that gets you from your virtual network to your physical network. Okay? Yep.
Sorry, is that VPN, multi-tenant VPN gateway an add-in from the System Center, or is that a third-party application?
No, it's actually a Microsoft, in the pre-release, it's a Windows Server, okay? We actually have a VM that you can run, or you can run it as a physical.
Okay.
Okay, it's an actual Windows Server.
It's an application, okay.
So it's a Windows Server that has a role and feature built onto it that does that VPN gateway for you. Okay, before, in 2012, without R2, you had to go to a third-party vendor to get an appliance or a device or a software version, okay? But in R2, we ship a device.
The bullet point up there, guest clustering for high availability, how does that gateway accomplish that?
So the gateway device can be clustered itself, but it also knows about clustering on VMs.
Oh, okay, so it's clustering aware. It sees it on a backend.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a lot of clustering, and we had to make it highly available because as a service provider, you don't want just one VM gateway. Okay, you're going to have that multi-redundant process. So as you can see on the diagram on the right, we have our Contoso cloud on the left, we have our Fabricam on the right, we have our SPS VPNs which go to the internet. Then the internet comes into your data center where you have your multi-tenant VPN gateway server. That gateway then talks to the host data center virtualization fabric, which is your VMM and your configurations on your hosts. And then the host will pass that traffic through to the VMs. Okay? Resource metering. So when we talk about resource metering in this session, we're talking about what's available in Windows 2012 and Hyper-V out of the box without Ops Manager. Okay? This is purely what's available at the hypervisor and Windows 2012 layer. Ops Manager will enhance and improve upon this, but this is what we're going to be able to do out of the box just with Windows Server. We're able to measure the amount of data center resources, so we're talking compute, network, and storage that's available to your VMs. We're also able to keep track of resource usage over a time. So if you want to know what your average CPU was, average memory usage was, we can pull that statistic as well. Okay? So until you reset the counters, it will keep counting, okay, and monitoring and capturing the resource information. We use resource pools to collect and aggregate virtual machine usage belonging to a client, allowing single point of queries. Okay, so if you've got multiple VMs, we can pull that information together, capture it, and present it as one report or one piece of information. We're able to use that information for billing and chargeback usage reporting. The resource meters can be used to measure incoming and outgoing network traffic on a per VM basis or over the whole Hyper-V extensible switch. Okay? But as I said, we can't go into real detail about where the traffic's going, where it's coming from, and things like that. All we can tell you is in and out details. The performance counters, Windows Server 2012, R2 introduced a heap of new performance counters for SMB2 file share usage, RDMA usage, network traffic, and VM metrics. So resource metering, some of the metrics we capture are average CPU utilization, minimum maximum memory usage. We also have maximum disk allocation, incoming and outgoing network traffic, incoming and outgoing storage IOPS, which is new in R2. Okay? We weren't able to capture IOPS in 2012 RTM. So when we look at the solution on the right, we can see that we have zero resource pool internet resource metering up the top. We have our resource pool internet customer 1 and customer 2. We then see our VM1, VM2, VM3, and then we can see VM1, 2, and 3 for customer 2 as well. The two-tenant environment built with Hyper-V in Windows 2012 is what you're seeing there. And as we watch the slide, we can see the traffic and everything going through the system. So you can see that virtual machine resourcing meter, we can see 45 on the blue, 40 on the orange. So we can isolate, report back just on that customer's total traffic over the whole of their series of VMs. Not just individual VMs, but we can do it on a whole basis. And then you can see the traffic going out. Obviously, blue and orange fighting to see who's going to be the champion of how much traffic's going in and out. So once you start, when we go through the labs, you're going to be able to play with that, see the traffic coming in and out, and do some other nice little demos later on. The benefit of the resource metering means that we can track the information. Okay? If you're going to use the Windows 2012 resource metering, there are some things you need to think about when you go through and use it for metering. One of the things is once you create the virtual machine, okay, you need to enable resource metering for that virtual machine. Okay? Out of the box virtual machine resource metering isn't turned on. Okay, you have to activate it. Once you create a new VM, if you're adding it to a new system, then you would create the metering. We would then query the resource metering report at the end of the month. Okay, so at the end of the billing period, you would query the resource metering report to get all the information. Once you've captured that information and you export it into your billing engine or however you want to take that data and use it, once you've taken that data off the system, you would reset your counters so that you can start capturing information for the next month. Okay? If you don't, you're going to have to do some weird and wonderful mathematical calculations of subtracting last month's from this month's figures and then keep going like that. Okay? Highly recommend. It's far easier to reset the counters at the end of each month. QoS. So when we talk about infrastructure as a service and guaranteeing SLAs and private and public clouds, it means that you need to be able to guarantee certain levels of allocation of shared resources, including your CPU, storage, and network. Protection from resource abuse, so you really need to protect customers from other customers. What happens if a customer doesn't have the security software that you told them to put on their server and they get hacked? You don't want that server all of a sudden pulling or publishing torrents or whatever it is to the rest of the world. You want to be able to make sure that you can contain that customer from affecting the performance on your other servers. We have QoS with Windows Server 2012 that'll let you set bandwidth limits on the network adapters. So you can either set a hard limit of 10 meg, 100 meg, gig, whatever it is you want, or you can set a percentage of the bandwidth, and we'll go through that in a little while. Some of the key enhancements is that we can support bandwidth floors as well as caps. So you can say a minimum amount or you can set a maximum amount. We're able to improve the level of service based on the type of traffic as well. We can also dynamically restrict disk throughput. So if the disk I/O starts to pick up, we can start enforcing QoS and enforce customers to use a specific amount of disk I/O. We can either configure it manually or automate it with scripts using Windows PowerShell. Okay? When we start looking at resource metering and QoS functionality, a lot of those configurations are done through PowerShell only. Not all of these features are in the Windows GUI. Okay? So for those of you that aren't PowerShell experts, don't stress. I've got a tool that will help you with PowerShell. All right? So we're giving you everything you need. So network QoS. We have two modes for network QoS. One is a restrictive minimum bandwidth, where we have the ability to set weightings. Okay? Relative means that I give a server a weighting of 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, and it's a percentage of the network that's available. Okay? So if I've got a 100 meg pipe or a 1 gig pipe, okay, they each get a percentage of the available network traffic. So if I've got 3 VMs and I've set them different ratings, okay, one may get 10%, one may get 20%, one may get 30% of the traffic that's available. Strict minimum bandwidth is where we set a specific amount of minimum traffic that that VM is entitled to. So on that diagram, we have bronze tenant, which gets 100 meg of network traffic guaranteed. Silver tenant gets 200 meg of traffic guaranteed, and gold tenant gets 500 meg of traffic guaranteed. And in this diagram, we have 1 gigabyte of traffic, okay? So in that diagram, we have 800 meg, okay? If I added another VM and it needed another 500 meg of traffic, I couldn't do it, okay? In strict minimum bandwidth mode, the VMs cannot oversubscribe the network adapter. If you've got 1 gig of traffic, you have 1 gig of traffic to assign to the VMs. That's why we recommend you use relative minimum bandwidth, where we're using percentages and weightings, not strict amounts. Okay? If you use strict amounts, you're going to run out fairly quickly if you're giving everyone lots of network throughput. Okay? And you'll need to add additional physical NICs. We've seen some people try and overcome that limitation by teaming NICs. Okay? So they team 2 1-gig NICs together and go, I've got 2 gigs worth of bandwidth. I'm going to try and subscribe 3 servers with 500 meg each. The system is smart enough not to let you do that. What Windows would do is say, you have 2 NICs in a team. We are in active-active mode. If I lose one of those NICs, I can't do 1.5 gig of traffic. Okay? It knows that it's an active-active or active-passive team, and it only realistically, in a worst-case scenario, has 1 gig of throughput. Okay? So you can't try and overcome it by teaming NICs together. All right? So either strict or relative. 90% of the time we see service providers use relative unless you have a customer with a very strict SLA. Okay? But then you need to be prepared to have additional network adapters. So how does it work? So when we look at this table, we see on the left-hand side we have a service. We have virtual machine, storage, live migration, and cluster shared volume. They're different network requirements. Okay. Reservations, we've given them a 30%, 40%, 20%, and 10% rating. So in T1, virtual machine needs 4 gigabits a second. Storage needs 5 gigabits a second. Live migration is not doing anything at the moment. And cluster shared volume traffic's doing 0.5 of a gig. Okay, so what you can see is here is they're all using whatever they need. Okay, the network's not that busy. All the VMs can use whatever traffic, or the host can use whatever traffic it needs. When the link becomes congested and we see that the requirement and demand for each of the different workloads increases, we can now see that they're forced to use the quota system. Okay, so because storage has a higher rating, okay, we can see that it gets a bigger chunk of the pie, or the bandwidth. When the bandwidth becomes available, the network's not really busy, each of the different network types grabs whatever traffic it needs. Okay, so the weighting system only kicks in if the network becomes busy. Okay, so you're really allowing VMs to use whatever traffic they need until the network becomes congested, and then they're forced to enable QoS. So storage enhancements with storage QoS. So we're now able to control the allocation of storage IOPS between VM disks. So some of the things you can do is you could have an OS VHDX and a data VHDX file attached to a VM, and you can specify the IO each disk gets. So if your OS drive doesn't need a lot of disk IOPS, you can drop it down. If your data VHDX you know is going to use a lot of disk IO, you can give it a higher quota. Okay? And again, you can limit that based on customers, and therefore you could charge customers that have higher disk IO requirements a higher premium. Customers that have lower disk IO requirements, you could charge a little bit less. So it gives us a whole new way of charging customers for storage. Because it's not just about how much disk they get, it's what type of disk IO they need. Customers with higher disk IO means they're probably sitting on your SSD storage or your SAS storage, and therefore they're going to be needed to be charged a premium. But you also want to start limiting customers from throttling the disk IO on your storage. Okay? If you have customers that are running databases on these VMs, you don't want, and you've got them on similar SSD storage or the same LAN or something like that, you want to be able to limit how much disk IO each customer's VM takes. So it's a very important process that you need to start looking at and going forward. How many of you at the moment know how many disk IOPS a customer's VM uses? 2 people? So it becomes really important when you start troubleshooting some of the storage issues you may be running into with slow performance and things like that, when we can start throttling those disk IOs. One of the key areas I find is if you have to reboot a host or a couple of hosts, or you have to shut down your whole cluster and bring it back up, has anyone watched the disk on your storage? Okay. If you do the disk IOPS quotering, it means that some servers that are higher priority will come up faster because they've got access to more disk IO. Okay, so it's another way we can try and give customers' servers a performance boost in the way that they come up. Yeah, so when you set the disk IO, you're setting the maximum disk IO.
Set that manually.
Yeah. So when you create the VHDX file and assign it to the VM, you can actually tell it what you want the disk IOPS maximum to be.
But that's per VM, is it?
That's per VHDX file that belongs to the VM.
Okay, but is there any way for the host to know what the host can offer?
So the question is there a way for the host to know what the disk IO it can offer is? No, because the host doesn't know what storage you've attached to it. Okay, so it doesn't know if it's sitting, if you've got a SAN plugged into it, it doesn't know what each disk shelf is capable of doing. So you have to tell it what you want it to be.
Can I set the configuration of the QoS from the VM endpoint to do it on every
So the question is, can I do it in VMM or do I have to do it on each Hyper-V host? You can do it in VMM. You can also script it so that when you create the VM, those configuration settings are done. So when you start looking at templates and automation, you can pre-configure some of those settings. So if a customer specific sets a SQL Server, for example, or a low-end SQL Server template, you can have it pre-configure the disks with the correct disk IOPS. Okay. We also support dynamic, fixed, and differencing disks. So you can do disk IOPS on any disk. It doesn't have to be a fixed disk. It can be dynamic, and it can be differencing. So as you can see, when one becomes busy, you can see the IOPS hit. You can see it drop back down again. And we can monitor and report on the IOPS. Okay? It's not just about limiting. You can actually capture the information as well. So VM mobility. So some of the mobility features are we have IP mobility, so being able to move customers into your environment without re-IPing. VPN connectivity through VPN site-to-site connectivity, whether you use the VPN gateway device or whether you use your own servers, that your own routing and VPN firewalls, etc. Live migrations, being able to move several VMs at the same time without having to worry about how many we're trying to do. Storage migration with zero downtime. 2012 introduced storage migration. We've now got compression and things like that in R2, so that we're able to live migrate the storage of a VM without actually having to live migrate the whole VM as well. So if you've got a SAN changeover you've got to do, so you've got a new SAN, you're plugging it in, you want to move the VMs, you can just attach the storage to the cluster, move the storage of the VM, not the whole VM, and you're done. So it makes any of those storage migration projects a lot simpler. Shared nothing live migration, we can actually move from VM from one host to another host. They don't have to be clustered. You can have totally standalone Hyper-V hosts and just move a VM from one to the other. There is no downtime, okay? The only downtime I've ever seen is normally one ping packet loss, and you'll hopefully see that in a demonstration, as long as the demos work the way we hope they do, okay? You will see one ping packet loss, and I haven't seen an application yet that fails because it can't connect to the server, okay? And it's normally you're waiting for the address tables and things like that to update on your switching and routing. Question?
With the shared nothing, I assume that the host that you're moving to has to have similar CPU flags and features still?
So the question is, when we do a live migration with shared nothing, does the destination server has to have the same sort of CPU, RAM, and other configurations? The answer is no. If you tick the box when you create your VM to allow to migrate the VM to another server with different physical CPUs, okay? So I could move from a physical host with 6 cores to a physical host with 2 cores. I can actually move the VM as long as I've ticked that box. It doesn't need a reboot. Okay?
What's the downside of ticking the box? What are you turning off?
So the only downside is the CPU performs a little bit less at 100%. Unless all of your Hyper-V hosts are identical, I recommend ticking the box, okay? Because if you do have to fail over, it comes down to, do you want to reboot that box?
And you can tick that box when it's off, right? So, like, I can have a VM that's running, and I know that I'm going to be doing a migration project soon. During a maintenance window, I can turn it on, getting ready for that?
Correct. So if you shut down the box, you can tick it. Bring the box back online, it updates the HAL and everything it needs to do for you to be able to do a live migration to a server with a different CPU. So question, yeah?
Does that still work, talking about the difference between AMD and Intel chips?
So the question is, does it work between AMD and Intel? The answer is no. You have to either move from Intel to Intel or AMD to AMD with a live migration. If you shut the box down, you can bring it over, it'll detect the new changes and bring it up, but you can't do a live migration between different CPU vendors.
This box is an on-off thing, or could you select its Westmere CPU or another kind of Intel CPU,
so,
different generations?
So the question is, can you pick different generations and things that it's going to be compatible with? The answer is no. It's either you're allowing it to move to different hardware or you're not allowing it to move to different hardware. without a reboot.
Does IP mobility, does it create a VPN tunnel?
So the IP mobility, does it create a VPN tunnel? Do you mean back to the customer's premise or between VMs in the environment? So if you want to be able to have a customer that has their IP in your cloud and they use the same IP address back in their data center or back in their premise, you have to have the VPN site-to-site tunnel.
So is it like a layer 2?
So it's a layer 2, layer 3, depending if you use NVGRE or if you're just doing a straight VPN to VPN. There's a couple of different ways you can do it depending on how you give your customer network connectivity. So some countries we have MPLS connections, other countries don't do MPLS. There's a whole range of different solutions there. So the Hyper-V network virtualization. So tenants with overlapping IP address ranges share the same physical network. We're not isolating them on your physical network, we're isolating them at the virtualization network. There are policies that enforce the host level using PowerShell or System Center Virtual Machine Manager. So if you want to configure virtual networks, they're the two methods you have available to you. You can't do it through a GUI on a Hyper-V host. All right, has to be done either as PowerShell or VMM. DHCP service can be part of a virtualized network. So if you've got a customer that wants to use DHCP, they can. So what's really happening at the back end is Blue sees a SQL server and a web server on 10.1.1.1 and 10.1.1.2. Down the bottom, what you see is a SQL server sitting on Hyper-V host 1 and the web server sitting on Hyper-V host 2. And they're sitting in a customer address space, okay? So their customer address space IP address is 10.1.1.2. The provider address space, so which is your network, is a 192.168.n.n address range. So what we see is a 192.168.1.10 address on the left, and we see a 192.168.2.12 address on the right. So what happens is the two servers use their 10.1.1. address. It gets translated to a 192.168 address. Okay, we now have orange, which sees a 10.1.1. address and a 10.1.12 address internally on their own private virtual network. But when they go out to the rest of the network, they're also going to get a 192.168 address as well. So the blue network, as you can see, 10.10.10 in their isolated networks, but then when they go out onto your address, the provider address, they're getting a 192.168.2 address, and they're all different. Okay? So there's a translation between the customer address and the provider address space, which then does the translation to your physical network, okay? So the translation occurs on the gateway, okay? So the gateway knows how to get communication between the different environments. The same as the hypervisor host will be part of that whole process of translation.
So that's a default network address translation scenario, or is there some special thing in that?
No, so the IPs that you use, you configure. Okay, so if you want them to use different addresses, you give them different addresses. Okay. So all of those addresses that are in the private space are routable to the external address space, which is on your physical network. NVGRE, using the generic routing encapsulation, means that we're also able to isolate with more flexibility without any VLAN complexity. The network virtualization using generic route encapsulation uses encapsulation and tunneling. The standard is proposed by both Microsoft, Intel, Arista Networks, HP, Dell, Emulex. There's a whole range of people that are working through that process. The VM traffic within the same VSID routable is routable over different physical subnets. The VM packets are encapsulated for transmission over your physical network. So you take your traffic, you encapsulate it, send it over your normal network, and then unpackage it on the other end and deliver it to the destination. So as you can see, they're on different subnets. We have our same customer network and VSID. So you can see that there's a translation there, there's a GRE key, there's a MAC, and the translation's done. Okay? There's a whole range of things you're going to have to learn about the NVGRE process. It's not going to be something I can stand up here and tell you how it all works and go into details in a five-minute conversation. So you will have to go back and go through how this process works in more detail and how it would work in your environment.
So you would do one or the other, the translation or the
NVGRE? So it really comes down to what you're trying to achieve. Are you just trying to get the VM onto your network or a physical network, or are you trying to make it look like they're all on the same one network? So if a customer's got a servers on their premise that need to talk to servers on your premise and they need to be on the same IP ranges or something like that, we can do it over NVGRE, and it doesn't, to the servers, it looks like they're on the same physical network. So it really comes down to what are you trying to achieve, what's the workload, what's the bandwidth requirements, and things like that. So cross-premise connectivity. So we're able to do VPN site-to-site functionality so that we can connect from one subnet to another subnet. So when we're not trying to be on the same subnets and same network, we would use a VPN site-to-site. We can use IKV2 IPsec tunnels, and we can use the VPN gateway server to do that as well. So here we can see Contoso trying to connect to their New York branch, their London branch. And then we have Woodgrove trying to do a... So in the top one, we're doing server to server, so Windows server to Windows server to gateway server. Down the bottom with Woodgrove, we're doing a VPN site-to-site tunnel from a Windows server to a firewall of some sort. Okay, so it doesn't have to be Windows gateway server to gateway server. It can be to a traditional gateway, firewall, or VPN device. So live migration. So there's some new and enhanced live migration features which enable us to do faster and easier processing than what we could in even 2012. So we're able to migrate lots of VMs at the same time. It comes down to your bandwidth. Okay, the bigger pipe you give it, the more we're going to be able to do. Even if you are using virtual networks, you can still live migrate your VMs. Okay? If you're using VMM to manage your virtual networks, it's going to be a much simpler process than if you're manually creating the VM networks yourself on each host that aren't being managed by VMM. Okay? So if you do virtual networks, please definitely use VMM. It's going to make your life much simpler. So we have an option now in R2 where we have live migration with compression. Okay, so we compress the traffic before we send it and then uncompress it on the other end. So the live migrations can occur a little bit faster. Okay, and we use less bandwidth for the translation. Live migration with RDMA offload, means that we're able to deliver even higher performance for live migrations. Okay, however, you need a network adapter that does RDMA. Okay, the offloading of the transfer to the hardware can enhance and speed up the transmission to up to 56 gigabits a second. Okay, so you've gone from a 10 meg pipe to 56. That's a pretty big significant change. And as I said, we see somewhere around about a third of the time, you pretty much use about a third of the time you would just do it compared to compression. Okay, so there's a massive change there. So it really comes down to investing in whether or not you can afford that technology, how you can use that technology, and whether it suits your solution. But you don't have to use RDMA. It's just another benefit of using it.
What's the CPU overhead when you use compression?
So the question is, what's the CPU overhead when you use compression? There is a slight performance. It's negligible, really. Personally, I would be using it, especially if you're on slower networks. If you're using 10 gigi and you're just dedicating a network adapter to live migration, you probably don't need it. But if you're going to be doing lots of migrations over slower networks, then I would suggest using it. So the way that the storage live migration works. When we're trying to move a storage from one device to another device, what happens is we have our virtual machine talking to our source device. Okay, so it's talking to the original storage device. What we do is we trigger a live storage migration. The storage starts to replicate from one source storage device to the other storage device. Once we get to a far enough point in the replication, we start to write to both devices. Okay? So the VM will start sending all the information it gets to both source and destination device. Once we have synchronized, all writes only go to the new target device. The source device is dropped from the VM and it's deleted. With a shared nothing migration, so where we're moving a whole VM and its storage from one server to the other, what we do is we replicate the configuration data between the two hosts. So from the source destination host to the destination Hyper-V host. We then initiate a storage replication. So the storage starts replicating from the source to the target. We then write, as before, once we get far enough through the replication process, the data coming into the VM is written to both locations. Once we're far enough in, the memory commit and memory pages are now starting to be replicated from one host to the other host as well. Once that's complete and the source devices are fully synchronized and everything's been moved and checked, we then detach the source storage, remove the VM from the original source, and then we remove the disk as well, and everything's left running on the production new server. So is there any improvements between 2012 and 2012 R2? I found it's a lot more stable than it was in RTM, and I have found it a little bit faster.
Well, specifically, what I found is if the VMs are live, it took about 3 times longer than if I shut them down first.
Yep. So the comment was that in RTM, when you do a live migration, if the VMs are running, it was taking a lot longer to migrate than if you shut down the VM and migrated it. One of the issues you have is when we do the live migrations on a running server is that everything's still going in RAM, and that's where we find most of the issue is how much is sitting in memory and how much is being written out. So when you're running a server that's live, we're finding that writing out the memory, depending on how much RAM you have that in that server, so if you have a server with 1 gig, it's not really a big issue. If you've got VMs that are running 12, 10 gig of RAM, it's taking a little bit longer. And also how active that server is. Okay? If you, one of the recommendations is that before you do a live migration on a VM, if you up the weighting on the RAM so that the server is higher up in the preferences of getting RAM available to it, if you up that and you also set some other configuration options that we can go through later, you'll be able to find a much faster live migration process. Okay? Because if you're waiting on the memory on the VM itself is low, it may be fighting other VMs for traffic, for RAM and things like that. Okay? So it's a much better option. If you can shut it down, it's going to be faster because you're not writing memory out. So shared nothing live migration, it's increasing the flexibility of the virtual machine placement. So here we have a shared nothing. We do a live migration. There's an IP configuration passed through. Disk contents are copied to the new destination VHD. And as you can see, we again go through the same process. The memory's contents written. And that's normally where we start to see a lot of slowness is in that memory process. Okay? If the servers are very heavily active, that's normally where the slowdown will be in the live migration. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a demo on the live migration. So I'm just going to switch over to my desktop. So we're just going to end this. So here I have my demo machine with my VMs running on this VM. I have demo 2, which has a heap of other VMs running on it. So on demo 1, I've got a server called Leon Server, and I'm going to migrate that VM from this machine to demo 2. So these machines have nothing in common. They are totally separate machines with the local disk only. So what I have here is I have my VM, so I've got a console connection to the VM. I can see the IP address is 10.10.10.154. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to kick off a ping to the box. So we can see a concurrent ping. And we're going to transfer this over our Ethernet adapter to the other server. So I'm going to right-click on the server, go to move, move the virtual machine. I'm going to type in demo 2. Click next. Here we have, we're going to move the data all to one location. So I have the options of moving the virtual's data by selecting where to move the items individually, or I can just move all the items to one single location. Or I could just move the VM, but because we're doing a shared nothing migration, I need to move the whole VM. So I select the destination, which is the drive. These are the drives on the actual destination machine, not my local machine. So I'm going to just put it in the VM folder. Click next. It just agrees with everything that I've said. So we hit finish. And we are now performing the move. So if I go back to my Hyper-V console, I can see we're moving the virtual machine. We're sitting at 6%. And this is going to take a little while. I can see the hard drive's going a little bit crazy on my machines. And while we've got that going, I can come down here to my ping. You can see that it's still going. If you shut down the VM, it will actually migrate quicker because we're not writing out memory and things like that. But this is a live migration, so we can see that it's actually in production, it's running. You can cut and compress this bit down when you do the edit. So this is why we don't recommend local SATA 5.5K drives. It takes a little while to copy. So as you can see, that VM is now migrated over. I can see Leon server over here on demo 2. And I'll just stop that copy for a second, that ping, sorry. Okay, and we scroll back up. And you can see there wasn't even a ping packet lost. Okay, so that's where I started the ping. And as we scroll down, you can see not one ping packet got dropped. So that's probably the best one I've seen. We can occasionally get one ping packet that gets dropped, but again, it comes down to the speed of your network, the disk, and how quickly the network transaction occurs. So that's the live migration over. Thanks very much. Come on. No one even told me that it finished. It went from 8 and 9% and then finished. So, staring intently at your lab. Okay.